Bonjour à tous. Je voudrais commencer par dire que c'est évidemment un honneur et un plaisir pour la chaire de métaphysique et de philosophie de la connaissance du professeur Tiercelin que de recevoir aujourd'hui Catherine Elgin, qui est professeure à la Graduate School of Education de l'Université de Harvard. Alors, avant que de laisser la parole à notre conférencière, permettez-moi de la présenter en quelques mots rapides. De manière générale, on peut dire que les recherches de Catherine Elgin s'inscrivent dans la tradition du pragmatisme américain, et notamment dans la lignée de l'œuvre du grand philosophe analytique Nelson Goodman, avec qui elle a directement collaboré. Plus précisément, je crois qu'on peut dire que Catherine Elgin est doublement épistémologue. Elle l'est tout d'abord au sens généralisé dans le monde anglo-saxon, qui comprend et définit l'épistémologie comme une philosophie de la connaissance, un programme qui, en ses murs, a bien sûr trouvé toute son importance dans les chaires de Jules Vimin, de Jacques Bouvresse et aujourd'hui de Claudine Tiercelin. Mais Catherine Elgin est aussi épistémologue en un autre sens du terme, qui est plus usuel en France et qui se rapporte cette fois à la philosophie des sciences. En réalité, ces deux dimensions que sont la philosophie des sciences et la philosophie de la connaissance sont indissociables dans l'œuvre de Catherine Elgin. Dans tous ses travaux, elle a en effet cherché à montrer d'une part que la philosophie de la connaissance ne saurait se construire sans prêter la plus grande attention à la pratique réelle de l'activité scientifique, tout en insistant en retour sur le fait que la science doit nécessairement être replacée dans le cadre d'une théorie générale et plus inclusive de la connaissance, qui ménage une place à d'autres types d'entreprises cognitives. L'œuvre de Catherine Elgin, à cet égard, peut se comprendre comme la tentative de développer une philosophie de la connaissance qui serait à même d'accommoder les contributions épistémiques irréductibles mais complémentaires, des sciences, des arts et de la philosophie. Alors aujourd'hui, c'est plus particulièrement autour du dernier livre de Catherine Elgin que nous sommes réunis. Donc, ce livre, intitulé « True Enough » et paru tout récemment au MIT Press, défend le projet d'une réorientation radicale de la philosophie de la connaissance. En ce sens, il prolonge un programme qui avait déjà été esquissé, de fait, dans un ouvrage de 1988, co-signé avec Nelson Goodman, et intitulé « Reconception en philosophie ». Alors, je voudrais maintenant dire simplement un mot rapide de cet ouvrage récent. Le fil rouge de cet ouvrage est sans doute le suivant. Catherine Elgin, dans « True Enough », défend que l'omniprésence des modèles, des idéalisations et des expériences de pensée, notamment dans les sciences, implique de renoncer à ce qu'elle appelle une conception véritiste, selon laquelle la seule chose qui compterait en épistémologie serait finalement la vérité, rien que la vérité et toute la vérité. Comme elle le remarque, les modèles, les idéalisations et les expériences de pensée ne sont pas vrais au sens strict. Pourtant, ils sont loin d'être des défauts ou des expédients temporaires, dans la mesure où ils occupent une place prépondérante dans les sciences, et en fait même une place inéliminable. Si nous suivions donc le véritisme pour n'accepter que ce que nous tenons pour vrai, nous devrions alors reconnaître qu'une bonne partie de la science est épistémologiquement défectueuse et donc inacceptable. Pour éviter cette conclusion hautement contre-intuitive et potentiellement désastreuse, Catherine Elgin défend que nous devons réviser l'idée selon laquelle tout succès cognitif implique nécessairement la vérité. L'existence de ces faussetés heureuses, que sont les modèles, les idéalisations ou les expériences de pensée, fournit ainsi le fondement de la critique que Catherine Elgin opère du véritisme. C'est cela aussi qui légitime en retour le déploiement d'une épistémologie fondée sur la notion non factive de compréhension. L'acceptabilité d'une croyance ou d'un énoncé, en bref, reposerait alors non pas sur le fait de savoir s'ils sont vrais, mais plutôt sur ce qu'ils permettent de nous faire comprendre en s'approchant suffisamment de la vérité, c'est-à-dire en étant « true enough ». Alors, le dernier ouvrage de Catherine Elgin comporte nombre de développements sur la notion d'exemplification, sur le cognitivisme esthétique, sur les désaccords, les vertus épistémiques, l'objectivité, le faillibilisme et beaucoup d'autres sujets. Mais une chose est sûre, ce qui résulte de tous ces développements est une théorie de la connaissance qui se veut bien plus inclusive que ce qui est placé sous ce nom, généralement dans la littérature contemporaine. C'est ce programme novateur qui a été dessiné dans son dernier ouvrage et en fait plus largement dans toute sa carrière philosophique que Catherine Elgin va maintenant nous présenter.
Thank you. Well, thank you for inviting me, and I'm sorry I speak English, but you would hate to hear me in French. What I want to do today is sketch out the general themes in True Enough, because the idea sounds very radical, And I think it's not as radical as it seems, but we'll see. So here's the background. At the end of the last century and forward from there, there's been a conviction in at least Anglo-American philosophy of science that science aims at the truth, that science is getting the truth, that in the limit of science, this was a Putnam and Sellers view, at the end of inquiry, we'll arrive at the truth. And it occurred to me, after probably far too many years, that my husband, who was a scientist, and his friends who were scientists, don't talk that way. They don't think, they don't claim we've got the truth, you know. And some of them are very arrogant, so it's not that they're being modest about this. It's just it seemed that what they have is, or what they'll claim to have, is a viable model. So I tried to figure out what was going on. And you could still say, as people like Putnam at some points and Thomas Nagel say, well, they'll get there. But I decided to try to take their view of what they were up to more seriously. However, if they don't claim to be getting at knowledge, then we have a problem. Because science seems to be cognitively valuable, and so the question is, what's the cognitive value here if it isn't somewhere in the neighborhood of truth? That's what I was trying to work on. And it became evident to me that to answer that question, the way I put it is we have to move from concerns about knowledge to concerns about understanding. That is to say, take a more holistic view. We can't do the sort of thing that standard American epistemologists do, take one proposition at a time. Is it true? Is it justified? Is it reliably produced? Put it on the yes list, and you know it. Put it on the no list, and you don't. But it's done sentence at a time. Because basically what you have in science is a whole system of interconnected commitments that stand or fall together. So I thought we had to move into understanding, and in particular into a conception of understanding that Jonathan Fonvig calls objectual understanding, that is to say, an understanding of a topic or a field, a whole body of stuff taken together. And we have to ask what underwrites, gives us reason to credit that sort of thing. That's problematic enough, but that pushes to yet another worry, which is here's what standard American epistemologists would say that I can't say. The claims that are accepted are likely to be true. The methods or standards are truth conducive, because if I'm saying we have to back away from truth, then I can't very well say that the methods consist in promoting or underwriting truth. So I had to reconceive the epistemic norms as well. And what I'll do today is kind of go through a little sketch of how this whole thing works, and I'll get to the point about how the arts figure in it at the end, we hope. So standard epistemology, I think, valorizes truth. Something is creditable epistemically only if it's true. And the notion of truth we should recognize here is a very mundane notion. It's not claiming anything elevated. It's claiming snow is white is true if and only if snow is white. Love is blind is true if and only if love is blind. So just what you get from the Tarski T sentences. So when I'm saying we're backing away from something that isn't all that grand. I mean, and still I'm saying it's too ambitious. So I think if we consider everyday statements of matters of fact, the requirement of truth seems quite reasonable. If you tell me the train is late, and I take you to know it, then You didn't know it if the train isn't late. It had to be true or else you didn't know it. And for ordinary mundane things, I think that the kind of standard knowledge requires truth and we're after knowledge, so we're after truth view works reasonably well. But it doesn't work when we consider science, because science relies on models and idealizations and thought experiments that are known not to be true. It's not that people think there are frictionless planes or think that there are ideal gases. They know perfectly well from the outset that there are no such things. And it's something, we have the frictionless plane, we have certainly in population biology, but basically in virtually anything that uses statistics, you end up talking about infinite populations, even if you know that the number of things you're talking about in the real world is finite. So that's pretty far afield. Then we have, if you do economics, we can worry about the rational economic agent, who's this guy whose preferences are mutually consistent and transitive. Well, our preferences aren't. And there's all this psychological evidence that, you know, shows that we violate this. And if you don't want to go in for a psych experiment, you could just go down to Baskin-Robbins and say, I prefer flavor A to flavor B, flavor B to flavor C, flavor C to flavor A, and I can't figure out what kind of ice cream I want. And this is perfectly ordinary. But economics is going to have this rational agent view. So we have another one. We have the ideal gas, which you all probably had in high school, if not later. That's PV equals NRT. And it's a relation of pressure, temperature, and volume in a sample of gas. Well, what gas? Well, a gas that's made up of molecules that are dimensionless spheres that exhibit no mutual attraction. That is, they don't relate to each other by gravity, that don't bang into each other when they're moving about. And, you know, I just violated about 5 laws of nature in giving you that description, and even 1 law of mathematics about how something can be a dimensionless sphere. But it's still a very viable model. So there's something funny going on here if we say that truth is the currency we should be trafficking in, because we know perfectly well they're not true. But nobody's going to say, well, you know, science is just a bunch of superstitions. It's not credible anyway. We don't have to worry about it. I think we have to explain why it's okay to use these things. And one answer that's normally given is, okay, these models, you can say they're not eliminable now, but they will be eliminated eventually. So, you know, it's an outstanding problem for the field, but, you know, gas dynamicists will get over worrying about molecules that don't exist and get on with molecules that do exist. But there's a problem with this. The problem is that scientists do not seem to have any inclination to eliminate models. They expect the current models to be replaced by better models. And so they don't say that today's model is going to last forever. But what they want is better models and better models and better models. And so at least they're not claiming that they're looking to eliminate modeling. They think it's a very valuable tool. Then there's another problem. Even if you wanted to say, well, as Putnam might have, that, in the fullness of time, they'll be eliminated. The problem is current science is really creditable. We're not taking out a loan and hoping that our descendants will pay it off so that we can get retrospective credit for having got it right. So I think that's a problem anyway. So, okay, you say, okay, well, we can't do it that way. We can't do the, you know, taking out a loan on future science view. So maybe they're approximately true. And there are several reasons for not being happy with the idea that these models and idealizations are approximately true. One is that it's not clear what we might mean by approximately true. And here are some things that you could mean that are divergent from each other. One is a model or a representation is close to true in all cases, but there's just a little margin of error. Another would be, well, it's true in most cases, but there are a few outliers. Another would be, and this is the one you need for econ, is it's true in the aggregate, even though it's not true or nearly true, or anywhere in the vicinity of true for any individual case. It's just, I mean, if you think about something like how the economists who are modeling, say, the automobile market go, well, you're irrational in one way, and you're irrational in a completely different way, but they cancel each other out. So on average, the two of you are rational, even though there's no single individual who is. And that's another way you could get the approximation going. And we don't know which of these we're talking about, but whether we take any of these or some other notion, there's another problem, which is the following. Here's something that's absolutely lovely about truth. The conjunction of any two truths is true. So you can just do beautiful logical reasoning if you've got truths going. But the conjunction of two things that are approximately true is not always approximately true. They may pull in different directions, so you're getting indefinitely far from the truth. If you think that one of the things that makes truth so likable, which I agree this is why truth is likable, is that logic can be done very nicely if you're dealing with sentences you take to be true, you lose that with the approximation view. Here's an example that should make this clear. Here are two models of the nucleus of an atom. One treats the nucleus as a rigid shell, and you do all sorts of inferences, assuming rigidity and a fixed shape for the nucleus. Another treats it as a liquid drop. Now, whatever benefits you get of either one, you're not going to get it if you say it's a rigid liquid drop, because that doesn't make any sense. So you have to pick your model and work with it rather than saying that you just combine them and we'll get something good. And then there's the problem that there are some excellent models that are not even approximately true. One that I quite like is Snell's model of the relation of the angle of incidence to the angle of refraction when light travels from one medium to another, which you had in high school as the angle of incidence equals the angle of refraction when the light goes from air to water. It's not always equal, but there's always a fixed proportion. Assuming both media are isotropic, but most media are not isotropic. So Snell's rule is wrong more than 50% of the time. So why is it a good law? Well, mainly because it's right about the cases that the scientists care about. And if it doesn't work for some ridiculous pairing, my favorite one is light traveling from through shampoo and bending when it goes into wine. This is something scientists have never asked about, and because it's a dumb thing to do. But it doesn't work for these cases. So you can't say that Snell's law is approximately true, because whatever approximate means, being wrong most of the time doesn't go with it. And then there's another one that I mentioned earlier. The infinite populations. There's no such thing as being approximately infinite. You might say, well, a big population is closer to being infinite than a small population. But actually, mathematically, that's false. Actually, they're equally far. So if you're going to be using infinite populations in your reasoning, you can't say it's because, well, you know, there really are, you know, a lot of organisms, so let's let it be infinite and we won't be that far off. Because mathematically, that doesn't make any sense at all. So I think that the approximation move is just unwelcome. So you say, okay, fine, there's a lot of trouble here. What do I have in mind as an alternative? And what I suggest, I introduce this notion of a felicitous falsehood, where something, I call it a falsehood if it's strictly inaccurate, if it doesn't accurately represent whatever phenomena it is. And I call it felicitous if it nonetheless affords epistemic access to the phenomena. And I'm going to suggest that this is actually what happens, and it's not that strange. So I say models, idealizations, and thought experiments are felicitously false. But something is going to be felicitous. I mean, the falsehood you can get for free, but the felicity is going to be context or inquiry bound. Something is not just already felicitous. It's if you want to know this or you want to understand this, to this from this perspective, to this level of precision, it does no harm to treat the substance as frictionless. Why? Because friction is going to play such a minor role that it won't impede your understanding. So you have to know enough to know that it's going to play a minor role rather than a major role. And so you can see only in the context of a lot of background acceptances are you going to be able to say it's felicitous. So I suggest then that we have to go more holistic and talk about understanding of a subject matter, a topic, a domain of inquiry, rather than just knowledge of individual statements of fact, the truth of individual statements of fact. So you can wonder about what I mean by understanding. And as I use the term understanding, it's an epistemic commitment to a comprehensive, systematically linked body of information where the system is in reflective equilibrium, which I'll get to in a second. And that system is duly grounded in fact, is responsive to evidence, and enables non-trivial inference, argument, and maybe action regarding the phenomena the information pertains to. So all of that needs to be spelled out. So let me begin by talking about reflective equilibrium. And this is something that Rawls took from Quine and elaborated, and I take from Rawls because, Rawls took from Goodman rather, and I elaborate it further, I elaborate it in the direction of epistemology, whereas Rawls was just using it for political philosophy. And the basic idea is this: a network of commitments is in reflective equilibrium just in case its individual components are reasonable in light of one another, and the system as a whole is as reasonable as any available alternative in light of our antecedent commitments about the subject at hand. So since we have these antecedents, which serve as anchors, but here's the important thing about reflective equilibrium. To say you have these antecedent commitments, these are things you start with in weaving your equilibrium, but you may find that they have to be given up. So if you had something that you thought was a plausible starting point, and you find as you systematize that it just doesn't stand up to inquiry, that's perfectly okay. Although for at least most cases, if you give something up, you ought to be able to explain why it seemed as plausible as it did when it did. So if you thought, for example, that mass and weight were the same magnitude, why not? If you never get far from the Earth, there's not going to be a discrepancy. But if you start worrying about falling bodies on other planets or other celestial objects or out there in space or something, you're going to see that in the notion of weight, you've incorporated something that was too Earth-based to be viable. So you have to say, okay, it made perfectly good sense when all the people were doing were sort of dropping things from, you know, this high, but it's not going to work. So I've incorporated it by explaining why it was a plausible thing to hold back in the day. And that's the kind of picture we want for what the objects that tether our system are, why they are reasonable prior to our systematization. The other thing you should see is that you can introduce new commitments in the process of systematization in order to get the most viable system you can. And here my favorite example was the introduction of the positron in physics. Here's how they, before anybody could detect any such thing, here's what the story was. Every subatomic particle except the electron had an antiparticle. So you could either say, electrons are just different, which isn't really a very lovely thing for your science to say, because it leaves this dangler. What's different about electrons? Why are they different? Why should everything else be symmetrical but electrons aren't? Or you can say, maybe there's this other particle that's a positive counterpart to the negative charge of the electron. And they said, yes, that's a more viable thing. It's, you know, introduced as a theoretical posit, because the theory as a whole with the positron made better overall sense than the theory without it. Now, having said all of this, you should probably see that if I say all I want is a bunch of commitments in reflective equilibrium, I haven't said that each one of those propositional commitments, the ones that are propositional, have to be true. I said they have to be mutually supportive and the whole thing must be well grounded. But if the best way to make sense of your thermodynamics is to start introducing ideal gases, and when the whole thermodynamics works out, you get plausible readings for relationships between temperature, pressure, and volume, putting in this felicitous falsehood makes good sense. So on the picture I'm talking about, the fact that we've got idealizations and models in our account is not by itself objectionable, assuming the account as a whole stands up, as well as any available alternative. And that's a very important thing. It's not that you can say anything you want. You've got to consider the competition. Now, I suggest then, and actually this is another, when I started with it, I thought it was just a terminological point, but I now realize it isn't. I suggest that rather than asking about what you should believe, you should ask about what you should accept. And the notion of acceptance that I am using is one that was developed by L. Jonathan Cohen, where he says to accept something is to be willing, and I add, and able, to use it as a basis for inference or action when your goals are cognitive. So it's not an idle belief. I mean, you might have these beliefs that just kind of stay with you, but you never act on them. Then Cohen would say you don't accept it. And you might also have something you accept but don't believe. So you might accept that there are positrons, but you're one of these observationist guys and you think, I'm not going to believe it till I see it. So for example, actually a historical example, they're perfectly willing to reason with the Higgs boson before anybody found it. That would be a matter of acceptance. But I think that the reason I say I don't think this is just a sort of trivial turn of phrase thing is because I think that reasoning with is a really crucial matter here. It's not merely, you know, giving a list of things. You know, you can imagine some sort of exam. Which of these do you accept? Yes, yes, no. And that wouldn't be good enough. You want to say, what can you do with it? What will you do with it? If you checked yes on something and were unwilling to do anything with it, you wouldn't really accept it. However, if I do this, I've got this picture of understanding that consists of systematic networks of commitments in reflective equilibrium that you endorse and that are as good as any available alternative. May include falsehoods, fine. But that's going to lead to a problem about really what the norm of acceptance or the norms of acceptance ought to be. Because in standard, at least Anglo-American epistemology, the norms of epistemic acceptance have to deal with being truth conducive. So a method is acceptable if it's reliable. It's reliable if it is apt to generate truths. A norm is acceptable only if it's apt to validate truths and invalidate falsehoods. But since I've said truth is going to be not a central notion here, I can't very well say that our methods and standards are going to be truth, or ought to be truth conduciveness, because I'm going to fail by my own test if I do that. So I need something else. And the move I make here is something I find in virtue epistemology, but I don't think it's just virtue epistemology that can make use of it. In fact, I use it in a Kantian way that the virtue epistemologists are not happy with. And I suggest that rather than grounding acceptability in reliability, we should ground it in responsibility. So rather than saying that there's an external aim like truth, we're trying to get at the truth, does this do it, does this not, I say what we want to do is ask whether our methods of generating, validating, testing, and so forth satisfy our evolving standards for the understanding of the subject we're in. And I steal from Kant's ethics, actually. Kant says, one version of the categorical imperative is that an agent should accept a maxim only should act on a maxim, I guess, only if she would accept it as a legislating member of a realm of ends. And I suggest that something analogous happens in the epistemic realm. An epistemic agent should accept only such considerations as could be reflectively endorsed as legislating members of a realm of epistemic ends. So basically the idea is you have something in the epistemic realm that's equivalent to the categorical imperative. And this particular version of the categorical imperative is quite likable from my point of view. For epistemology, I'm not going to say anything about whether we should be Kantians about ethics, but as I said, I'm kind of stealing this idea. Always an ethical thing to do. The idea is this. Okay, a realm of epistemic ends. It's really quite important in Kant's formulation. He doesn't say you should act on this maxim if you could accept it as a philosopher king. So satisfying your own standards and thinking quite well of it yourself, Kant's not going to give you any of that. He says legislating member of a realm of ends. And here's the thing. Legislators, assuming they legislate, which in the United States they seem not to, they have to work together. And they have to work together to do something where, I mean, suppose you've got some idea about you'd like to enact some legislation. You've got to convince the other legislators that this is a good idea. So something that seems right from your perspective, you've got to say must seem also right from their perspective, or else they're not going to sign off on it. And so there's a communitarian element here, because what's right, what I can, and it actually goes quite deep, because the only things I can actually rationally justify for myself are going to be things that you could rationally justify, because I recognize that if you're my equal, then if you can't justify it from your point of view, I shouldn't go beyond accepting it either. So the idea here is we generate communities of inquiry and devise methods and standards and procedures and so on to promote our growing epistemic end. So this is an evolving picture. This is not, you know, here's something where, you know, from the word go, everybody ought to have been doing, and it makes no difference. But if you think about things like various scientific methods or various scientific standards, you see how this makes sense. You might have thought initially all you needed was observational agreement. But then you might say, if we both look at the same corrupt experiment, we'll both agree to the same thing, but because there was something, you know, some infelicity in the experiment, we'll both be wrong together. So once you realize that that's a problem, you say, okay, we need retest agreement, and we've got to say this has to stand up to further testing. And as we keep finding inadequacies, our views evolve about what needs to be done. And so we get, you know, first you just experimented, then the experiments had to be blind, then the experiments had to be double blind, then the experiments had to be double blind with the protagonist chosen randomly. And in each one of these things, we're correcting for a weakness we found in our previous methods. And it's not as though there was some sort of God of methodology whose standards we're approximating. We're just trying to figure out what will prevent the mistakes that we now know we're making. Now, the other thing that I should mention about this community of epistemic ends that I'm talking about, it's an idealized community. It's not a real community. So, I mean, even though it's somewhat modeled on the notion of a scientific community, we've got to idealize. Because in real communities, there are problems about power and privilege. And so I argue that the members of the community in the realm of epistemic ends, they have to be, in a political sense, free and equal. And that means if you're free, you are at liberty to venture any hypothesis that you think is worth taking seriously. If you're equal, then the community has an obligation to treat your hypothesis as worthy of an inquiry as any other hypothesis that's offered. Now, this doesn't mean that they're epistemically equal. This is very important. I mean, it might be a really dumb idea. So you freely offer it, and it gets smacked down fast because you ignored something that we all agree can't be ignored. But we'd want that to be the case whether you, the person who freely offered this hypothesis, was a lowly graduate student or Frau Dr. Professor. It's the idea itself that's got to be the unit of assessment and not the power or prestige of the proposer. And I think, I mean, this is something that we've seen a certain amount of in work in feminist epistemology on problems having to do with silencing. So you see in Mary-Kate McGowan's work and Miranda Fricker's work, the idea of testimonial injustice that comes about when people's word is not given its due. And, well, Fricker takes this very seriously from a moral point of view, as she should. I'm not saying this is a bad idea, but I think it's also important to take it seriously from an epistemic point of view. Because if someone's word is not given its due, then we lose information. And there's a very good historical example of this. It's Barbara McClintock. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, she did a series of experiments on the biology of corn, where she discovered that genetic information moves around the chromosome. It doesn't always stay in the same place. And it used to be that chromosomes were thought to be like beads on a string. And if you have your pearls on a string, This is not going to move. It's going to stay in the place it is. And if that was your conception of what's going on with the chromosome, McClintock must have been wrong, but she had the evidence. And there's a very kind of poignant passage where she says that basically, you know, people just wouldn't listen to her. And so she ended up kind of putting this work aside because nobody would listen to her about this. And then in 1960, Jacques Monod and Pierre Jacob discovered the same thing on chromosomes of E. coli. Then everybody said, "Eureka, we found it." And there was a big genetic advance. But it could have happened 10 years earlier if only they'd listened to McClintock. Now, it might be, I just want to put this as a footnote, it might be, and I probably think it is, that this was due to sexism. Basically, you know, McClintock was a woman, and women were not considered really top-notch scientists, so who's going to listen to her when she says something radical? But there's another possibility that's equally worrisome, and some historians of science believe it. It wasn't a prejudice against McClintock. It was a prejudice against corn. They didn't like research that was done on corn. So there was prejudice either way, but which prejudice it was is something that the historians of science are still arguing about. But however you settle this issue, the point is information was lost by the failure to give these results their due in the first place. And if you had simply said, well, we've got to check this out, you know, you don't like corn, do it again on something else in 1950 rather than in 1960. Or you don't like women, then get some man to check her out and, you know, see what the result is. But I think that the reason why I put in this bit about free and equal is that it seems that it's epistemically costly to let relations of power and prestige dominate, since good ideas can come from a variety of perspectives, and we lose a lot. So, assuming we get this far, there's a worry that should be lurking in your minds, and that's a worry about objectivity. If I say that all we need is accounts that are true enough, I say you can incorporate falsehoods into your evolving system of thought, am I going to let, is this thing going to become so subjective that the flat earthers and the astrologists and everybody else are going to be epistemically legitimate because after all they've got their own whatever? And I don't think so, because there are at least two, there's a single notion of objectivity that has two modes of realization that I think is perfectly available to me. The notion of objectivity that we want is we want to control against idiosyncrasy, bias, and chance. So if you can do that, you've got a measure of objectivity. And I want to point out two ways in which we can do that. We control against these factors if a method or standard is impartial or impersonal. If it's impersonal, then what we effectively do is offload our own personal judgments onto an instrument. So rather than just saying, how cold does it seem to you? We invent a thermometer. And then the thermometer gives us an instrument that will tell us hot and cold, and we've offloaded our personal take on things onto the instrument. But this is important. Hasuk Chang wrote a really good book called The Invention of Temperature about the invention of the thermometer and about how many quirky, idiosyncratic things went into the invention of the thermometer. One example, these are very easy things, which is why I understand them. Suppose you've gotten as far as deciding that you want to ground the thermometer in the freezing point and boiling point of water. Okay, now here's the bad news. The temperature, what we now call the temperature at which water boils, is sensitive to altitude. So are you going to calibrate your thermometer in Mexico City or in New Orleans or maybe in Paris, which is somewhere in between? Then there's also the question about when is the water boiling? Well, when it bubbles. How much does it have to bubble? Does it have to be vigorously bubbling, or do you call it boiling when the first bubble pops up? These things, you had to make these, and these were decisions they had to make. They weren't that you could read off nature how many bubbles it takes for something to count as boiling. So in inventing this machine, gizmo, measuring instrument, there were decisions that could have been made otherwise and could responsibly have been made otherwise that went into settling this. But now that it's settled, we have a very good way of measuring temperature. So that's the case where you have something that we've made impersonal by saying, let the instrument decide, now that we've come up with the instrument. The other one is where we don't have an instrument, we haven't offloaded completely, but we have an impartial measure. We still want to control for bias, idiosyncrasy, and chance. And a good model of this, actually, is Olympic diving competitions. Because what you have there is actually really quite interesting. Typically, you have 9 judges. They're trained judges. They're told what the parameters they're supposed to judge on, and only on. So this and that and the other. There are 9 of them, and they're told what the, let's say, the criterion for perfect success is. So entering the water with your legs perfectly straight. Problem comes in asking how much to take off for how far off from perfectly straight. And that's where judgment comes in. So how are we going to control for idiosyncrasy? Answer, first you've got 9 judges. Drop off the top score and the bottom score. So if you're, you know, favoring your favorite candidate or just a nut on the subject of straight legs, your score is going to be discounted. Then you average the rest. And you get a very consistent measure from one diver to the next. So you've got a measure of objectivity because you've thrown in ways to discount certain things. And you don't want, I mean, I picked the diving bit because it's amazingly regimented. The diving scorebook is about this thick, telling you what you should pay attention to. But people who work in the social sciences doing qualitative research do something very similar. So, for example, if you wanted to know whether infants under the age of 1 recognize their father's voices, which is the sort of thing, you know, developmental psychologists want to know about, here's what you would do. Okay, you get a bunch of little kids, and you tape voices, male voices, so the kid can't see who's speaking, and you see whether the child responds differently to her own father's voice than to other voices. So what's the criterion for responding differently? I mean, these are little babies. They're doing stuff all over the place. They're not sitting there, you know, pressing a button, you know, like you might do in an auditory test. So what they do is they train observers to note what differences there are and how big a difference accounts to make a difference. And then they say, you know, you want inter-rater agreement here. And they get results this way. But basically, they're doing the same sort of thing they do in the diving test by saying, if we can get enough people to agree on this, we've controlled for chance readings. And so I think we can then say it is impartial. It's not that, you know, these qualitative researchers just kind of make things up. And you can find cases where you don't get agreement, and then you just say, We don't know what to say. Maybe bring in more advisors. Maybe the test wasn't fine enough. Maybe the kid was distracted. But you do something because you want an impartial verdict here, and you get it. So we get some kind of objectivity here, and we get some kind of ground for thinking that things are acceptable if they're responsibly generated and responsibly validated. Now, this doesn't guarantee that they're right. I mean, this is not a method that's going to guarantee truth, but this, I mean, that may just be the way the world is. You know, I don't think we can guarantee truth. I actually think Descartes was right when he said in the Meditations, he could only secure knowledge if he could prove that God exists and is not a deceiver. Because otherwise, there's always a possibility that our best efforts might fail. Well, he couldn't. He couldn't prove it. Nobody else can prove it. So we're in a state where we no guarantees. And I think if you're in a state where there's no guarantees, there's something that's really quite nice about the picture that I'm giving. And that's what I talk about with respect to what you might think of as a Berkeleyan world, where Berkeley's, you know, basically said that your claims are right if they align with the ideas in the mind of God, and wrong otherwise. Okay. So here's the thing: suppose that God is the malevolent demon. Just let it be that. You have to align with the malevolent demon. And if you had a reliabilist account, a kind of standard epistemological account, then you'd say, well, you're never right, you're never epistemically creditable, all bets are off. And, you know, I mean, if you want to be right, that's true. But then you couldn't explain what would be admirable, epistemically admirable, about a scrupulous scientist who gathered and assessed evidence using the best methods possible and came to the conclusion that most accommodated the evidence. Now, there's something admirable about that epistemically, even if the conclusion is still false. And there's something unadmirable about some slipshod guy who just jumps to conclusion, doesn't give a damn, and goes to the beach every day. And if you want to say that there's still something admirable about the scientist in the Berkeleyan world, then being a responsibilist rather than a reliabilist is an excellent thing. So it's not an answer to skepticism, but it is kind of saying that whatever you say about whether the malevolent demon hypothesis is correct, there's a lot more that texture that might be given to our epistemic situation. Now, I started out by talking about scientific models, and I kind of stopped, but we should get back to that. And so the question is, now that I've got this reliable, this responsibilist method, I've got this notion of objectivity and so forth on the table, how can I talk about what the models or felicitous falsehoods are doing? And here's what I say. I want to say that a felicitous falsehood, it may be false, but it's false in a respect that doesn't matter for the understanding it's producing. This is rather like what Michael Strevens talks about when he says that certain ways of being wrong are not difference makers. And what that means, or what I think it means, is a model has a kind of a structure that enables it to highlight certain features of a situation. So PV equals NRT highlights the relationship between pressure, temperature, and volume. And it, by in this case, through its silence, but it wouldn't have to be through its silence, it simply omits other features of the geometry of gas molecules. It omits gravitational attraction among gas molecules. And it says, if you ignore this stuff that I've omitted, I can show you a pattern that will hold in reality. So the idea would be that the The model exemplifies, that is, makes manifest a particular pattern. And if the model's a good one, it obtains in reality. So you kind of indirectly, you go, you know, here's the model. It's got a lot of properties. Some of these are exemplified, which is to say that the model both instantiates them and refers to them. You access them, and then you impute them to the real-world phenomena. And imputing them doesn't mean saying that the real-world phenomena has them. It means saying it does no harm to think of it as though these the real world has them, whereupon you get a plausible account. If this is right, then we can see a bunch of different things. I mean, if you think instead, I've been talking mainly about models here, but we could also think about thought experiments. So you have, for example, Einstein asking about what you would see if you were riding on a light wave. Well, here's the answer. You can't ride on a light wave because it's way too small. If you were riding on a light wave, you'd be going so fast that you'd be pulverized. And if you weren't pulverized, the first photon that came along would knock off your head because it would be bigger than your head. And Einstein says, yeah, but prescind from all those complications, then let's ask what we'd see. And you find out some important things about what the claim that the speed of light is finite gives you. So you set up this pretend situation where you prescind from all these impossibilia and then think about what you'd see and you gain some insight. And so you understand what the theory commits you to a lot better, but not because you think you could do it. It's not like an experiment that's a thought experiment only because we didn't get the funding to do it. It's that you had to distance yourself from confounding factors in order to see what was there to be seen. And I suggest here that on this view, with the idea that exemplification is a real referential notion that affords epistemic access, we can understand how scientific models function. And here's the nice payoff. You also understand how works of art function. Because if, first easy case, a thought experiment is a fiction. It's just a little story. And say, understand this story correctly, and you'll know something about light waves. You can build up from this in a very systematic way to get the fictions bigger, and you can think about the history of philosophy. So we have the Republic. You have Émile. You have these elaborate philosophical thought experiments that are, you know, extended fictions that reveal something that we say is very important philosophically. You then have, kind of minimalist novels that are, think first about didactic novels like Animal Form or something, where, you know, there's a message being told that you're supposed to get when you read these. And then you just work yourself up to more and more complicated fictions, but the very same sorts of things are going on as go on in the minimalist fictions and the thought experiments. And so asking how we can gain understanding through fiction is going to be answering the same question as, well, how'd you do it for Einstein? Obviously things need to get elaborated a bit, but they can be elaborated. We can do the same thing with models and idealizations, where the simplifying elements were integral to supplying the understanding. So if a work of art simplifies something away, it may be in the service of enabling us to access something that in the blooming, buzzing confusion with all the confounding variables is just too complicated to see. But once you've seen it, you can go out in the world and say, oh, that's what was going on. Now I see what it was. Because in this other work, fictional work in this limited context, I managed to understand it. And so I think the interesting or uninteresting consequence of all of this is if If I'm right about the sorts of things, I didn't have to be right about all the details, but the sorts of things that are required to make sense of the way we do science and take that science to be providing us with understanding, we have the resources for understanding how art supplies understanding as well. Thank you.